I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one, at a dicey moment for healthcare reform, Obamacare, in the Congress and the country. This one is about the underlying rules of the game that is now 75 years old, without a victory yet for the venerable idea of universal or national health insurance. Our guest, James Marone, is the political science chairman at Brown. He's the co-author of an amazing study, if I may say, that makes healthcare very personal and very presidential. Healthcare politics, going back to Franklin Roosevelt, turns out to be an intimate test and revelation of presidential temperament. And in Jim Marone's history with David Blumenthal, healthcare also has an uncanny connection with the health history of one president after another. FDR's semi-secret polio, Dwight D. Eisenhower's heart attacks, and his mother-in-law's medical bills, John Kennedy's several death's door afflictions, and his father's stroke while he was president. The stories are endless. We'll get to a lot of them. But the question, Jim Marone, for starters, is about the present. Something's not right in the Obama healthcare pitch. So begin with that. What's off and how bad is it?
This is the classic story. Over and over again, presidents have come charging out with what appears to be a very popular plan, a problem in the country. We need better health care. We need a more rational system. And boom, they suddenly hit the political atmosphere and its turbulence. How's Obama doing? He's doing better than most. This thing has gotten further along than most. If you think of Clinton's plan at this point, that is September, early fall of the first year, Clinton's plan was not yet written. It hadn't even appeared before Congress. So the outcry, the outrage, the socialism, this is old stuff. Harry Truman's supporters took out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And what did those ads say? This is not socialism. And that in the middle of the Red Scares. So par for the course, at least in terms of the reaction. But the question you're about to ask, that you have to ask, is why would any president suffer this when they've seen what's gone before them? Battle after battle, and as you say, victory not yet in sight. And I think the answer comes down to the deeply personal.
From my angle, though, the Obama thing is in more trouble than you suggest. As Jon Stewart, who tells the truth, said on The Daily Show, you know a sales pitch is in trouble when the proponents are saying, we're not here to kill your grandma.
No one's ever prepared for this. So you can hear intellectually that, oh, there's going to be outrage. But every time the Democrats, and it's usually Democrats pushing this, though ironically Republicans have been more successful at getting health care, usually the Democrats are very focused on the policy details. How do we get this right? And they know there's going to be opposition, but they think they're prepared for it. And then the opposition hits, and it's so much more ferocious. Harry Truman was suggesting something that most nations were suggesting at the time and that the people have voted for. This, after all, was the major campaign promise of the 1948 election, the famous Dewey defeats Truman election. As he went around the country and he proposed national health insurance, people were screaming, give him hell, Harry. It looked like this was a popular thing. And yet he gets into Congress and Senator Taft, the conservative, fiery in temperament, but in conservatism, a minority leader, says this is the most socialistic thing that has come before this body. And Chris, it's 1949. We're at the height of the Red Scare, calling something socialistic. Them's fighting words back then. Harry was not prepared for it. I mean, he was prepared in theory, but not in practice. And we've gone through the same thing all over again. If you talk to the Obama people ahead of time, they would have said, oh, we're girded. We're ready. Whatever they throw at us, we know it's going to be ugly. But not this ugly. Not all reason down the drain. Throw grandma off the train. This is deep. Why is it so deep? That's the interesting question here, really. What is this touch? And I got two answers to that. One, this is the thing that Franklin Roosevelt never fought for in the New Deal. So he gets unemployment compensation, he gets welfare, he gets Social Security, he gets the whole list of good welfare state stuff, but he pulls back on health care. So for Democrats, this is the lost reform that the New Deal never won. And for the Republicans, this is what distinguishes the United States from all those other welfare states like Denmark, like Canada, like France. So that this is in the DNA, in the genetic code of each party. Ask a Democrat and they'll say shamefully, we're the only industrialized country without national health insurance. Republicans, we're the only country without national health insurance. So this is a battle about America. Plus, so that's one level. That's bad enough. Add to that that this is the battle for the high ground in Washington. If Obama wins something significant, if he wins, if it's significant, two very big ifs, he has done something that Truman, that Carter, that Kennedy, that Clinton couldn't have done. He emerges from this a star. If the Republicans manages to either make this a very weak bill or to defeat it, Obama becomes Carter. He's defeated. This is Waterloo. James DeMint, senator from South Carolina, is absolutely right. But remember, Waterloo had both Wellington and Napoleon. There's a winner that comes out of this, and the winner is dominating the Washington conversation for the next year. So we are met on the great battlefield. Of course it's ugly. Of course it's bloody. Control of our politics is at stake.
I'm still to be sold that it's that important this year in a kind of scorecard Waterloo football, you know, we've got to win kind of thing. But we'll come back to that. Your book, Jim, lays out a variety of rules, eight of them, big ones, by which, for example, Lyndon Johnson got Medicare and Jimmy Carter didn't get health insurance. It has to do with presidential passion, detail, keeping the wonk, the policy wonks sort of out of the picture, keeping the economists and the numbers out of the picture, all this sort of thing. I want to get to that. And yet the larger moral of your book is it's all about presidential personality. And it reveals, historically, but even in the moment, things we didn't know about our presidents. What is it telling you about the strengths and the weaknesses, the personality, even the health history of Barack Obama and his modus operandi, his choice of his timing, his relations to Congress? I mean, what's the news there that you see about our president?
That's a great question. So the very first thing you see, and the unexpected law, is the law of passion. If you don't care about this, as Jimmy Carter didn't really care about it, you will wither in the crossfire. So the moment that my co-author and I thought, ooh, this is going to be big now, was at the very end of the campaign when Obama is standing there in front of his supporters weeping about his grandmother's death. And then we went back, or I went back and reread his book about his mother's death and the idea of her having to fight the insurance companies. These presidents as a group are very sick individuals, much sicker than the average American male. But what really moves them is not their own diseases. As you mentioned, President Kennedy, last rites of the Catholic Church four times as an adult, his father weeping as his son is about to die. That didn't budge him at all. He was tough. But when his father has a stroke, Medicare shoots up the importance for the president. He is now making speeches for Medicare. First rule, Obama's tears over his grandmother's death and his passion about his mother's struggle with the insurance company as she died of cancer, this premature death, that put the fire in his soul for this issue. He's willing to put huge stakes on this. We know that there was a meeting in the White House after Tom Daschle, the nominee who was going to run this, former majority and minority leader in Congress and the Senate, when he crashed and burned over tax issues. There was a meeting in the White House in which all the economists said, oh, not now, the plate is full. And a couple of people pushed the other way, and Obama went with the minority. 5-2, the yeas have it, even though it's 5 nays and 2 yeas. Why? Because he cares about this issue. So that's the first rule, passion, and he's got it for this issue.
We're also learning, though, that he's a wonk, too. He likes the policy details, and yet he's also left Congress a lot of room to write their own bill. I mean, what are these conflicting evidences telling
him? Yes. Obama is now being tarred with letting Congress write the bill. Dirty, rotten secret? Congress rewrites all the bills. It's a marvelous political ploy, but Obama's got four principles, and those principles have, by and large, been the principles that this debate has been organized around. Now, people on the radio can't see this, but you're looking at me skeptically, like really you're trying to make Obama look good. I'm just saying that a lot of the claims that are being made are naive claims about the American congressional process. There's a reason we've been fighting about this for 75 years and not gotten national health insurance, and it's simply this. Congress is not designed for a big overhaul of America's largest industry. It's just a bad vehicle for doing it. So that the reason it's lost, it has to do with the way our institutions operate. How's Obama doing? Well, I would do it differently for sure. I would have a different bill. But given how many failures there have been, I'd actually say he's doing pretty well with a caveat. One of the rules of passing health insurance through Congress is go public and get a storm going in the public. I'd give him a B- on that. He had a great speech a couple of weeks ago, but he's been very slow off the mark. And learn to twist congressional arms. What we don't know about Obama, Chris, is how good he is behind the scenes at twisting congressional arms. I got two pieces of evidence that said, tell me, Obama's doing a lot better than anybody expects. First, when they were – now we're deep in the weeds. When they were looking at the budget reconciliation bill, the House put a time bomb in it. They said, if we don't pass health care by October 15th, we're going to treat it as a budget bill, which means no filibusters. The Senate said, are you kidding? We're not doing that. They go into the committee, and Obama's people go and say, we want the House version. And lo and behold, the Senate goes along. I would have bet the last penny I had, Chris, that there's no way the Senate would have gotten along. I don't know what Obama told them, but that was a real surprise. Number two, Jay Rockefeller says the minute that Baucus, the chairman of Senate Finance, floats his bill, no way the liberals can vote for this. No way I'm against it. This bill I will vote. He meets with Obama, and 12 hours later he says, well, we'll talk. I don't know what Obama told him. But when Bill Clinton was trying this, he met with people. It all spilled out in the press. So far, it's been secret. Early returns. It's the second inning. Early returns, Obama's twisting arms really well, and that's the sine qua non. Carter had no idea how to do it. Clinton had no idea how to do it. Dirty, rotten secret. Truman had no idea how to do it. Obama, in the second inning at least, is pitching pretty nicely. We got seven innings to go. We'll see how it goes.
The other side of the Lyndon Johnson mask was he was deep into all of the details in the personal negotiations. But as you tell the story, he was always saying, I don't care about the details, just we've got to get the bill for the old folks. Very, very simple language. I wonder whether Obama's made it simple enough.
It's gotten more and more complicated. There's no question. If we were back in 1965, there were some things that could be simple. The best example, of course, is the financing. Lyndon Johnson basically squelched conversation about the financing. We found one wonderful tape where this young senator just elected in 62 named Ted Kennedy calls Johnson for some advice on how you get a health bill through. And Johnson says, well, the first thing, don't let people project those costs out. They tried to project the Medicare costs out 5 years. You project it out a couple of years. They're saying it's going to cost $1 billion. Well, I don't know that I'm going to pay $1 billion. First thing I know, senators are running to me saying, it's $1 billion. I'm not going to pay for it. I'm not going to vote for it. So what he told Kennedy explicitly was, don't let them project the costs. There was another time when Wilbur Mills calls him and says, oh, this is costing, you know, we're $500 million under budget. And Johnson goes into a story. There was a guy named Al Caddy back in Texas. And when they caught him doing some things he couldn't do that was against the state constitution, why, Al Caddy said, hey, we're friends. What's the state constitution among friends? And I tell you, Wilbur, he says, and you can hear him now chewing his lunch. He says, I tell you, what's $500 billion between you and me? We friends, us friends, $500 million. I'll take care of it, Wilbur. I'll take care of it. Now, that kind of cavalier attitude about financing is impossible today. So when we say hush the economists, the most controversial thing in this book, there is a scene that takes place time and again. Every president has it. The economists walk into the office, they shake their heads, and they say, we, the federal government, can't afford this. And what any president who's going to go forward, whether it's Lyndon Johnson or George Bush, has to do is say, I'm going to find the money for this. You guys, you've got a narrower vision than I do. You want health care reform? The conversation can't be about the government deficit, or that will kill it. That's been true in every single presidency. But Lyndon Johnson, he was a master at finding different ways of telling people different things in the simple era when there was no CBO estimates, when there was no OMB. That was very different.
The whole cost thing has turned upside down, though, Jim, in all these years, in the sense that it's the cost of medical care as it is today, what it's doing to the federal budget, what it's doing to you and me, what it's doing to companies, General Motors among them, that's driving this whole thing. So that the cost that has to be contained is the problem out there now. It's the reason for the reform.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard President Obama really satisfy people that this is going to address the insane inflation of medical bills with all the technology that we can bring to, you know, MRIs for hangnails and this kind of thing. We've got to contain what we're spending.
Absolutely. You know, this is the cost we have to focus on. Every 4 years, the United States takes a penny out of every dollar we spend and shifts it to healthcare. Or another way of saying the percentage of GDP going to healthcare goes up every 1% every 4 or 5 years. The rest of the industrialized world, flat. It's just even. Costs are going up. They all complain about costs. It's killing the governments, but flat as percentage of the whole economy. And that's the cost people have to focus on, not the cost of the federal government and not the cost of the individual, the cost of the system as a whole, because as that goes up, it ripples through the system. That is to say, we can't solve any of the other costs until we stop the costs going to the healthcare system as a whole. Now, here's the other problem. No one wants to stop that cost rise. You'll hear good senators saying, we don't want Medicare pricing. What do they mean? They mean Medicare has actually been pretty tough on costs, 30% lower than the private insurance companies. It's a general rule. Governments are more stingy than private insurance companies. True of Medicare, true of Medicaid, and true of every national health insurance program around the world.
People tell me is still part of this fee-for-service game that is the fundamental cost driver of the whole engine.
Yes, that's right. Medicare is still part of the game, tougher than the other players in the game, which is why everybody says, we don't want Medicare pricing. What are they really saying, Chris? We don't want cost control.
That's true.
Cost control hurts. It's tough. So here's what Obama has to do. Look, imagine that Obama comes through with a real cost containment program. You know how many senators are going to vote for that? You know how many doctors will let their senators vote for that? What we've got to do, talking honest politics here on Open Source, what we got to do is a triple shot off three walls. What I'm lost in my billiards metaphor here, but it's a tricky shot into the side pocket. We got to set up the incentives that will help us go to cost control without directly hitting cost control, because you got three senators who'll vote for it, and that's the basic truth. You want a good cost control program? I'll give you one all-payer system. That'll give you cost control. You're not going to get more than three senators voting for it. Well, maybe 10. So we need to set up the incentives, and we can talk about how to do that. Here Obama's fallen. Here the Republicans have fallen. Here everybody's a coward. And I'll admit, Obama's a coward here too. Everybody's got an easy answer. Guess what? There is no costless, painless, bloodless way. We're going to have to tell the hospitals, no, you can't have that much money, like every other system does in the world. Is that rationing? You bet it is. But until we do, the costs are going to continue going up.
Jim, isn't that really another way of saying that nobody has addressed the fundamental, obvious problems, which would seem to me to be we have this a la carte fee-for-service, you know, run-the-bill-up kind of incentive system. We leave 40 million people out of care to begin with. And then we also have this private, very expensive insurance system, which nobody really, including Hillary and now the president, are willing to challenge.
That's true. There's no way around that. There's all these pieces that need fixing. You say 40 million out of the system, but then if you think about people who are uninsured, we're up to 70 or 80 million people. If you look at over a couple of years, how many people go in and out of insurance, again, the number goes up. It is an all a la carte system that's horribly ineffective. And yet finding the political will to look the medical system in the eye and say, we are going to do less. We're not going to let you do everything you can is devilishly difficult. You don't want to say it to individuals. You don't want to say it to your local hospital. You don't want to say it to a system as a whole. And yet, Chris, we're not going to get to 100% of the economy on healthcare. There's a wise guy economist at Princeton that keeps making estimates. When we'll have it all, wall-to-wall hospital, 100% of the economy. We've gotten to 5%, to 10%. We're now heading for 20%. We believe by 2020, my co-author and I, that we'll be at 20% of the economy. But sooner or later, we're going to have to start saying no to our insatiable demand. And what that's going to take is this. It's going to take somewhere a mechanism. Look, when you're deciding how much beer to buy, there's a mechanism, how much beer you can afford. When you're trying to decide how many jet fighters to buy, there's a mechanism, how much Congress wants to pay for. But for healthcare, we don't have a single mechanism that tells us, okay, here's how much we're going to spend. So we continue to pass the costs to hundreds of different payers without ever quite deciding, here's how much we're going to spend. To really fix the problem, we don't need some algorithm, some better methodology. We need a place somewhere in the system. It can be individuals. It can be the government. It can be Santa Claus. But we need one mechanism that tells us, here's how much we're going to spend. For every other good and service, as I say, whether it's jet fighters or the military or how much good red wine you're drinking, we've got that mechanism. We don't have it for healthcare. That's what we're really going to need.
But that's what I'm waiting for, forgive me, Jim, the president to say, that we cannot all drive Rolls Royces.
You know, the one problem is that there's no way to simply disassociate, you're poor, you get cheap care. No, you're looking at a patient that you can keep alive for $500,000. We're, as a society, probably not going to say, you get care, you don't get care, once we see them. But we do it secretly. If you don't have very good health insurance, you'll die. If you have very good health insurance and you can talk your insurance company into paying for it, you live. The people who say no rationing in the United States are telling an awful lie. Right now, we are rationing in this way. I've got good health insurance. If I have a brain tumor, that will spend $500,000 to keep me alive. My next-door neighbor in Leominster, New Hampshire, he's going to die. So that's the kind of rationing we have. So this whole conversation about do we control costs is laid over this reality of what it means to have 50, 60, 70, 80,000 people without health care. So we focus on costs, and we must, but we also want to think about what kind of society we are and whether this inequity, this rationing that we now have, is something we can look in the mirrors and say, we're okay with that. So that is this very complicated dance we're trying to do right now.
Jim, these are the kind of conversations that make me think, what if he had put this off till his second year? What if we had a much longer, more open, more discursive national conversation about some of these strange anomalies? I, for one, was very sorry to see the press, especially, and the game construct a framework in which he had to be Lyndon Johnson in his first year. Isn't there a case to be made against speed in this kind of process?
We're proponents of speed. We believe in speed. And we've been perhaps the most ardent voices for speed. A few days after his election, Lyndon Johnson got his entire staff together, his health staff together, and he said, I've just won the biggest majority that any president, it's a bit of an exaggeration because Roosevelt had won a bigger majority, but it was the second largest majority of any Democrat in history.
64, yes.
64, a landslide. And he said, every day I'm going to lose a little power. Every day I'm going to make someone angry. And he said, you got to get Medicare right away. He knew that he had to get as much legislation through as fast as he could because every day he was going to lose a little power. Look, you think it's bad in Washington now. Next January, when we come back for the start of the second session, all the media, you aside, all the media is going to want to talk about is the next congressional election. And if you think we can have a serious conversation with everybody posturing to run for the next election, we just have different views of the science of politics. So Obama has more credibility in his first year as president than he'll ever have again. this isn't always true now. You can say, well, George Bush won new credibility after 9/11. And that's true. Lyndon Johnson had incredible credibility after the death of Kennedy. So a national trauma does change the rules. But generally speaking, this is so difficult that unfortunately, given the congressional process, given our process of government, if a president is going to win, we believe it has to be very quickly.
Jim, what does it say that, historically speaking, it was the doctors, the AMA in Roosevelt's time and since, that were tooth and nail against socialized medicine? And today, the insurance companies, for one thing, they're the people who say go, no go on a procedure, but they are the institutional block. How different is that for Obama?
That's a huge change that people haven't really wrapped their minds around, and you're right to point it out. In 35, when Roosevelt was wondering, should I put this in the Social Security package along with everything else that went in 1934-35, some very influential physicians, a doctor named Cushing, very powerful doctor who happened to be the father of a beautiful, beautiful woman who married Roosevelt's son. The marriage didn't last, but Cushing's influence did. Cushing just said, look, you can't do this. You can't, Franklin, you can't put health care in with Social Security. It's too complicated. Leave it to the doctors. And Franklin listened. Roosevelt listened. So the AMA got this incredible reputation of being a giant killer. And they were their great opponents of medical care because they were afraid they would lose control of their practice if government got into the business. And lo and behold, they fought government off, and from behind, from the wings, they lost control of their practices. Costs became so high that insurance companies began to regulate physician behavior, the very thing that motivated physicians to fight against socialized medicine. We will lose control of our practice. Happened, but not at the hands of government, but at the hands of capitalism. So that now insurance companies, if a doctor wants to do something, he's got to call an 800 number and get the okay from the insurance company. So in fact, what they fought for, their autonomy, they lost. If you talk to physicians in France or Germany or anywhere in the world, they'll say, yes, I can't believe the way the American physicians have permitted themselves to be bought off. Their salaries are high, but their autonomy is low. And that's actually true. One of the great untapped resources, one of the passionate supporters of some government intervention now, are the doctors. Doctors out there listening to the show know that they might actually be able to reassert control. And it's a trade-off many of them would make. Well, bring less money into the system. We'll be able to treat people without thinking about doing the wallet biopsy, do you have a good insurance or not, before we treat you, and just give us our autonomy back.
Right. It's what's called socialize the insurance and save private medicine. Restore my relationship with the doctor. A decisive, you know, two-party conversation about what's best
for you. You can only have choice in one of these realms. You can only you can socialize payment and choose your doctor, or you can keep private payment and essentially control doctors. Doctors are not socialized, they're capitalized. That is, the insurance companies essentially get to run. The payers get to run physicians' offices. And that's when people keep saying, we want choice in our medical system. We've come to a fork in the road. You can have a choice of payer, or you can have a choice of the kinds of physician practices you want. But it's getting to be increasingly difficult to have choice in both.
Jim, we're going to have to do this over and over again. I'd love to do a sort of month-by-month scorecard.
Let's do
nobody,
that.
Nobody knows it more shrewdly than you. Before we quit on this one, though, come back to what you say is also the big thread through many presidents and all this whole story is Barack Obama's own health story. What does it matter that he's got the best jump shot probably ever in the White House? He's lithe, athletic, got a beautiful, healthy, young wife. How does the man's own personal health story shape what's coming up?
The great surprise for us as we go through the presidents, we expected that the sick group of men would really be moved by their own health stories. And the answer is not at all. Their health doesn't matter to them. What always matters is the health of their loved ones. The stroke of the Kennedy, the sickness of Mrs. Dowd, Dwight Eisenhower's mother-in-law. Again and again, it's the health and the problems of loved ones that really speaks, that really gives them their passion.
The brothers that Richard Nixon lost to tuberculosis. Richard
Nixon was traumatized by the death of two brothers to tuberculosis and was the most passionate. When he got most passionate, that's what he went back to. As he left the White House in tears, what did he remember? His mother going off to care for his older brother, taking in other tubercular children who would die one after another.
The woman was a saint. The story that drives this is
his mother's death to cancer, fighting the insurance companies. His grandmother's death, he tearfully describes at the end of his campaign. He's passionate about this because he's seen the women he's loved most die in a healthcare system that was ungenerous to them. One final lesson that has to be remembered, and all Democrats hope it doesn't have to be counted on: learn to lose. When Harry Truman lost national health insurance, he was ferocious. The Republicans stopped something the Americans wanted, but they cannot never stop it forever. He fought and he fought and he fought, even after it was no chance. And he kept a dream alive. When Johnson signs Medicare, he decides to go out to Independence, Missouri, and sign it in front of Harry Truman. His advisors say, don't. That was socialized medicine. Harry says, no. Lyndon says, no, I will. And he signs it side by side to Harry Truman in the greatest liberal moment of the 20th century. These two lions look at one another. And Lyndon turns to Harry and says, only you, Mr. President, can understand how I feel. And Truman grasps his arm and says, this is the happiest moment of my life. Compare Bill Clinton. He loses. This was a bill the Republicans feared. We know it from their own memos, that if it had passed, it might have reconnected, in Bill Kristol's terms, the Democratic Party with the middle class. It loses, and Bill Clinton walks away. What does he say in his autobiography? I felt bad for Hillary. I should have kicked the can down the road, he says, a line quoted in Obama's speech. We're not kicking this can down the road, says Obama. What happens then is the spin, the story, the history is left to the opponents of the bill. Everybody knows for a fact that the Clinton plan was a disaster. National health insurance disappears for 10 years. Clinton didn't know how to lose. National health insurance disappears for 10 years, and perhaps not inconsequentially, so do the Democratic majorities. Learn to lose. If it comes to that, Obama has to leave this issue for the next generation and not walk away from it the way Bill Clinton did.
You write in this wonderful book, and as I said, it's called The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. It's all about how you leave the issue. You still think it's winnable. Jim Marrone, we got to talk about this early and often, as they say. I really enjoy it, and I'm thrilled about your book.
Well, thanks so much, Chris, and I hope we get to do this again.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with the Brown University political science chairman, James Marrone. His book with David Blumenthal is titled The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, from the University of California Press. Leave your own two bits on our website. Is the healthcare bill Waterloo, as Jim Marrone says? And then, is President Obama Napoleon or the Duke of Wellington? Measure the battlefield. Place yourself on it with a comment at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for joining the conversation.